From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Swiss authorities crack down on Davos protesters demonstrating against the World Economic Forum, where chief executive officers meet with political leaders from around the world. Governments and media owners crack down on the press around the world. And unnatural disasters. We'll take a look at the earthquake in El Salvador and the death toll in its wake. Was it as a result of the earthquake or the policies of international financial institutions? All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. President Bush is moving to tap religious institutions for more charitable work, confronting critics who say using public money for such programs could violate the wall between church and state. Today, Bush is expected to establish a White House office that will distribute billions of dollars to religious groups and charities over the next 10 years. The president wants to let such groups compete for taxpayer money to provide after-school programs, prison ministries, and drug treatment, among other things. To build support, Bush will meet throughout the week with leaders of spiritual and charitable groups. Madeleine O'Hare, the atheist who instituted the suit that ended prayer in schools, would be turning in her grave if Texas police had not just dug up her bones. As police were locating her remains, the Bush administration is promoting the role of faith-based institutions in addressing secular problems. Bones unearthed by investigators at a remote Texas ranch this weekend may solve the puzzling disappearance of the atheist leader, Madeleine Murray O'Hare, 5 years ago. Just days after reaching a secret plea bargain with the top suspect in her disappearance, state and federal investigators return this weekend to the sprawling 5,000-acre Cooksey Ranch in Texas, where they have long suspected O'Hare and her two adult children might be buried. Vice President Dick Cheney yesterday declined to rule out a Bush administration effort to overturn Roe v. Wade, the landmark Supreme Court decision that legalized abortion. When asked on NBC's Meet the Press if the Bush administration will not try to overturn the 1973 decision, Cheney replied, "I didn't say that." He continued, though, quote, "President Bush and I have talked, both of us strong supporters of the pro-life position, and the president's made it very clear the policy of this administration will be to try to find ways to reduce the incidence of abortion," he said. Cheney's comments came less than a week after President Bush, on his first working day in office, sparked an uproar when he banned federal funds for international family planning groups that provide abortion counseling. Fidel Castro last week fired his first verbal shot at President Bush since he took office, saying he hoped his new adversary in the White House, quote, is not as stupid as he seems. In a nationally televised speech, Castro said that, quote, someone very strange with very little promise has taken charge of the leadership of the great empire that we have as a neighbor. The Cuban leader said that gentleman has arrived there and hopefully he is not as stupid as he seems, nor as mafia-like as his background makes him appear. Here, President Bush has expressed support for the four-decade American trade embargo on Cuba. Thousands of shock survivors slept in the open rather than risk entering shelters yesterday in India, as Western India experienced fresh tremors after an earthquake in which at least 20,000 people are feared dead. Officials appealed for calm as families pushed injured relatives in hand carts urgently seeking medical help between heaps of rubble up to 25 feet high. Some survivors lost patients during long waits for fuel. Rescuers admitted 2 days after the quake that they were now mostly searching for bodies. The quake on Friday, India's Republic Day holiday, measured 7.9 on the Richter scale and cut a swathe of destruction across the prosperous agricultural and industrial state of Gujarat, from its commercial capital, Ahmedabad, to the coastal marshes of Kutch near the epicenter. Officials were unable to give an accurate death toll from the quake, the most powerful to hit India in half a century, as many people were still buried under the rubble. Colombia's president, cutting short a visit to Europe, met with members of his government yesterday trying to salvage peace talks with rebels as a crucial deadline nears. On Wednesday, Andres Pastrana must decide whether to send in troops to retake the Switzerland-sized haven in southern Colombia, ceded to the FARC. Doing so would mark the end of negotiations with the rebels and could spark an escalation in the nation's already bloody 37-year armed conflict. Some 3,000 Colombian soldiers are poised to retake the rebel stronghold. And this news from Bogota: gunmen killed at least 10 people and wounded 5 others in a northern town today in Colombia's latest massacre. The attack came as the military announced an investigation into its handling of a January 17th massacre in another village where residents accused the army of failing to respond to their pleas for protection. And this news... On a sad note, longtime peace and anti-nuclear activist Samuel Day Jr. passed away on Friday morning at his home in Madison, Wisconsin. Day was 74 years old. He died of a massive stroke. He began his activist career as a journalist, including a stint as editor of the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists and later as managing editor of the Madison, Wisconsin-based Progressive magazine. After leaving the Progressive, Day founded Nuke Watch, a public interest group that monitored U.S. nuclear deployment. He was arrested numerous times for protests at U.S. weapons facilities, and in 91 suffered a stroke while in prison that caused him to lose his eyesight. In the last years of his life, Day was U.S. coordinator for the campaign to free Mordechai Vanunu, jailed Israeli nuclear whistleblower. Sam Day was also very active in advocating for the rights of the visually impaired in Wisconsin. Longtime peace activist and former Madison fire chief Ed Durkin said Sam Day had more moral courage than anyone I ever met.
Victims of oppression, for the tyrants fear your might. Don't cling so hard to your possessions, for you have nothing if you have no rights. Let racist ignorance be ended, for respect makes the empires fall. Freedom is merely privilege extended, unless enjoyed.
Billy Bragg singing the Internationale here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Well, as the annual meeting of the World Economic Forum has taken place in Davos, a gathering of chief executive officers and heads of state from around the world, protesters have been protesting outside. About 30 protesters still in jail in Zurich. At least 70 people have been arrested. At least 4 people are hospitalized. Outrage and condemnation from Swiss major media, as well as from civil society and victimized Swiss citizens against the Swiss government officials and what they're calling robocops, growing by the minute, also disclosed that police had plans to use liquid manure against the protesters. We're joined right now by a number of people from the area to let us know what exactly has happened. We go first to Peter Bouchard, who is with the Bern Declaration, a Swiss advocacy group that helped to coordinate the public eye on Davos Forum. We also will be speaking with Tony Juniper, who is with Friends of the Earth International, and we go to him right now. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Hello.
Hi. Can you tell us what has happened and where you are?
Well, I'm right now in Davos. I've been here for several days, keeping an eye on the World Economic Forum, trying to liaise with the media to put a different point of view about what's wrong with the global economy and to put forward alternatives, and also to have discussions here amongst activists about strategies for changing some of the economic policies that are being discussed just a little way down the road here. It's been pretty difficult to protest, though, on the streets. People have been unable to get up here simply for wearing jeans. It's been that bad. The police have really been exercising quite dreadful prejudices in turning people away for having the wrong kind of hairdo or the wrong kind of clothes. And it's been a very tense place to be in the last few days, almost like a police state.
Can you describe the scene when the protests actually happened?
Well, there was a very small protest in Davos in the end. A few people managed to get up here from the railway down the valley, and a few people arrived by road. There was, in the end, a protest comprising about 200 people, but the police had really sealed the place off, and there was almost no way to get up here to join in the street protests. There was a very small and peaceful gathering that was attacked by a police water cannon, but thankfully for the protesters, the police hadn't succeeded in their plan to get cattle manure to fuel this particular anti-protest device, not least because the local farmers agreed with the activists that the global economy is bad for small farmers everywhere and wouldn't cooperate with the police on those grounds if no other. So it's been quite a difficult place to do public protest, but I think we've been very successful, the activists who have been here, in raising criticisms in the media about the World Economic Forum and certainly drawing attention to the dreadful tactics that have been used by the police to suppress protest here. And I think it's worth adding that whilst we've been up here trying to make our points peacefully and have had the police effectively trying to stop us, the Swiss taxpayer has paid out some 9 million Swiss francs to protect the World Economic Forum here in terms of the policing operation that's taken place. So there's a real imbalance of priorities, let's say. The job of the police, we would argue, is to make sure that people can protest peacefully. And if people break the law, then the police have a job to do in dealing with that. But stopping people coming to protest in the first place really is a problem, and many of us believe a breach of the International Convention on Human Rights.
We're joined, in addition to Tony Juniper, Friends of the Earth International, who is speaking to us from Davos, by Peter Bouchard of the Berne Declaration, the Swiss advocacy group that helped to coordinate an alternative economic forum called the Public Eye on Davos Forum. He is with us from Zurich. Can you describe what's happening there, Peter Bouchard?
Good morning. As you will have heard, Paris has really turned Davos into a fortress in the last few days. They denied access to thousands of people who wanted to come up as protesters on Saturday. But even before, they prevented scores, if not more, people who wanted to attend our conference. And so while there was privileged access for the corporate leaders and government leaders who participated in the World Economic Forum, the freedom of speech was not allowed for people who wanted to criticize economic globalization and who wanted to attend our conference. As you have heard, the demonstration, which took place in the end in Davos, the small demonstration, was completely peaceful from the side of the protesters, but there was strong protests also down the valley and in Zurich.
We're also joined from Zurich by Andreas Zumach, German journalist based in Switzerland. Can you tell us from your perspective the latest news you have of the number of people in prison, in jail at this point, and the response of Swiss population to the crackdown on the protesters?
Well, the latest number I have correspondence with a number you just heard from my two colleagues, which is 31 people, but I wouldn't be 100% sure that there are not more people somewhere in jail. We all don't know about it. As far as public opinion is concerned, my assessment of the major newspapers in the country is both in the German language part and even more here in the French-speaking part around Geneva. Never before has public opinion been so critical vis-à-vis this event, the Economic Forum, which now takes place since 31 years. And I wouldn't exclude at all the possibility that this might have been the last time that this forum took place in the country. And this not only the people in the area, in Davos and surrounding cities, who have been mostly affected also by the police and police state measures we have been described, but it's also people far away who don't think that it's worth to protect, private event for many, many millions of Swiss francs against legitimate criticism. And I would not rule out that in the coming weeks we might have a public debate here that in the end will have the conclusion that this meeting should take place somewhere else. And let me add something else. Since I have been in Seattle in December 1998 at the World Trade Organization, where the first big demonstrations and mass actions took place. I also have been in Prague at the World Bank and International Fund meeting. And I should say that at none of these places, neither in Prague nor in Seattle or in Washington, D.C., for that matter, last year at the World Bank meeting, the state authorities and the police have been so restrictive and have been so hysterical, I should say, vis-a-vis what I still would call legitimate criticism of neoliberal globalization.
Peter Bouchard of the Berne Declaration. We've heard some word that Vandana Shiva, the well-known Indian anti-globalization activist, was hurt in the protests in Davos. What do you know?
Vandana Shiva was a participant both of the World Economic Forum and of our independent public eye on Davos conference. She participated in the peaceful demonstration and she was hit by a policeman at least three times for absolutely no reason whatsoever. Vandana Shiva has been involved as a nonviolent peaceful activist in social movement for more than 30 years, and she said it's the first time ever that she was physically attacked by the state police here in Switzerland. But I should add that, I mean, Vandana Shiva is obviously shaken by the experience, but she is safe and well, so there was no injury at the end.
Tony Juniper, can you talk about the issues raised in the alternative forum? We focus a lot on the actions of the police and all of these events. Unfortunately, I think that's why the media ends up covering them, if at all. But the major issues put forward by those that are opposing the World Economic Forum or the ideas that come out of the summit of the CEOs and political leaders.
Yes, I think one of the things to bear in mind is that no matter how remote these particular summits are made. We've just heard, for example, that the next World Trade Organization meeting will be in the desert dictatorship of Qatar, a country with a very bad human rights record where protest is illegal. And we've seen what's happened up here in Davos with the police effectively sealing the town off. There's a trend here where these meetings that are promoting neoliberal economic globalization are being moved further and further away from people, further and further away from the opportunity to protest, and further away, more importantly, from popular opinion. And what we've been discussing up here is some very powerful new ideas about relocalizing economies, about reflecting ecological limits, about human rights, about equity, and looking at the policy forums where we can make these very powerful ideas become real through changing trade policies and the policies that presently permit corporations to run roughshod across the world. And those new ideas, no matter how remote you make your next World Trade Summit, no matter how much barbed wire put up or how many policemen you hire, they're never going to stop the growth of new ideas being developed by activist movements across the world. And while we've been meeting up here in Davos and discussing things like financial liberalization, trade policy, questions to do with regulation of corporations, for example, in Brazil, many thousands of activists have been meeting in parallel with the World Economic Forum to globalize ideas which are about protecting local communities, local diversity across the entire globe. And that is a very powerful movement that no amount of barbed wire and riot police is going to stop.
Andres Zumach, we saw in Seattle the different military and police authorities working together against the protesters. They were the Seattle Police, State Troopers, Army, Navy, Navy SEALs, Marines. What are you seeing in terms of the authorities' presence in Zurich?
Well, as far as the presence during the whole weekend, we saw not only police, but we also saw the Swiss Army being used against protesters, and even before that, to block off the whole area, streets, to stop the trains from running on schedule, etc. And many people, lawyers and others, question whether this wasn't an illegal abolishment of constitutional rights and whether the use of the army for this kind of measures isn't a breach of the Swiss constitution. I mean, this all will be clarified over the next coming weeks.
And international police?
International police, as far as border controls are concerned, I know that at least on the German-Swiss border, German police has been somewhat helpful to the Swiss police by stopping people who came from Germany or who intended to come from Germany. I hear that the same might have been true here at the French and Swiss border, though I haven't witnessed it myself, and also at the Italian-Swiss border. So there is a kind of... And what we do know is that the Swiss authorities used... international computer files and data given to them either by Interpol or the European system Europol, where they could screen or pre-screen potential participants in demonstrations and make sure that they could identify them in time to block them from reaching Davos or even from reaching Swiss territory.
Well, I want to thank you all for being with us, André Sumach, German journalist based in Switzerland, as well as Tony Juniper of Friends of the Earth International in Davos, and Peter Bouchard with the Berne Declaration, the Swiss advocacy group that helped to coordinate the alternative to the World Economic Forum called Public Eye on Davos. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! When we come back, as we've been following the Czech TV story of journalists who've taken over the TV station to fight for journalistic independence, we're going to speak with journalists from around the world about the issue of censorship. You're listening to Democracy Now! Back in a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. All over the world, journalists are targeted for their work. Some are murdered, some are fired, some are banned or harassed, some are simply not rehired because they've taken stands that offend governments, editors, or media owners. Of the 24 journalists killed for their work in the year 2000, the Committee to Protect Journalists noted that the majority did not die in crossfire. They were very deliberately targeted for elimination because of their reporting. In December, for example, suspected right-wing paramilitary gunmen killed Colombian radio journalist Alfredo Abad Lopez as he was saying goodbye to his wife outside their home. Government investigators said he was apparently murdered in retaliation for his sharp criticism of local administration. In December, Panama's Legislative Assembly approved a bill repealing some of the more onerous provisions of the country's gag laws. The gag rules comprise a range of articles, laws, and decrees, many promulgated under military governments, that permit prior censorship and criminalize criticism of public officials. One decree still on the books permits a national board of censorship to restrict information deemed obscene, immoral, offensive to the basic principles of Christian morality. Dozens of journalists have been prosecuted under these laws. Today, we have with us three journalists who've experienced some of the various ways in which freedom of the press is curtailed. One was jailed after exposing government corruption and faced death threats against his family. One was fired for pursuing a story she believed in this country, for Fox News. And we are joined by, as we've been following the story of Czech television, the story of the Czech TV reporters who've engaged in a month-long sit-in at the state-run Czech TV newsroom. We'll start with Jan Malocek, reporter for the Foreign News Desk of the state-owned Czech TV in Prague. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Hello.
Can you tell us about where you stand now? Reporters extending their control last week, taking over management of the network as well. The move, the latest development in the four-week fight that began December 20th, when journalists holed up in the newsroom to protest the appointment of a new Czech TV director. He was actually chosen from inside the TV station. You've alleged that Jiří Hodák had close ties to political leaders and would compromise the political independence of your station. But there have been massive protests, thousands of people protesting in the streets. Are the journalists still inside?
Yes, we are still on strike. We are continuing our protests, although it's not so dramatic as it was in the first days. We are still staying in the newsroom overnight. We are taking turns. But what everybody is doing right now, we are waiting for the parliament a decision on the important question, who's going to be the temporary general director. The Czech parliament passed a new Czech Television Act according to which there are temporary regulations that shift the power of Czech Television Council, that's the supervision body that normally has the right to choose and appoint the general director. The power of this body is now temporarily shifted to the parliament itself. So it's up to the members of parliament now to pick up a temporary director general who can solve the crisis and make the situation ready for the interim period before the new proper general director is elected by the new Czech Television Council.
Mm-hmm. When the journalists first took over on Christmas weekend, when the appointment was made, this was a man who was from inside the Czech TV station who had been an employee there before?
No, it's not quite so. Mr. Hodák worked before for Czech Television. You are right in that. He worked for Czech Television as the news department director last year for about 4 months. And one of the reasons why we protested against his person was that our experience with him, because we have several very concrete and clear examples of his attempts to politically influence the output of our news.
And the response of the public, how did they learn about everything that was going on? Had you taken over the airwaves?
Well, we continued broadcasting our news bulletins. However, Mr. Hodák and his team, they got control of part of the terrestrial transmitters network, which is why we only about 10% of the Czech viewers could watch our news bulletins. The rest either got blackouts or alternative news bulletins produced by Mr. Hodák and his team. So we could only keep in contact with about 10% of our viewers. However, the other media, newspapers, and most of the TV stations reported extensively and regularly about the issue, so the public had access to the information.
Were there attempts to quash freedom of speech or impose a gag order?
Actually, yes, but they were not very strong. They never got strong support even within the political scene. They were rather isolated and individual opinions or suggestions made by some not very important politicians.
We're also joined on the phone here in the United States by Jane Akers. Jane Akers and Steve Wilson are two veteran news reporters from Fox TV in Tampa, Florida, who were fired for refusing to water down an investigative report on Monsanto's controversial milk hormone, recombinant bovine growth hormone known as RBGH. This is a story that we have covered for quite a long time. They got involved with a lawsuit against Fox TV executives after more than a year's work on the series and heavy promotion by Fox. 3 days before the series was scheduled to air in 1997, they received the first of two letters from lawyers representing Monsanto saying Monsanto would suffer enormous damage if the series ran, and it was canceled at the last moment. Jane Akers, where do you stand now with this case?
In August, I won my case against Fox and was awarded $425,000. Fox was found to have violated the state's whistleblower law. Fox has last week filed an appeal and posted a bond. So we are likely in this for the next year or two while the appeals process goes through the courts.
The substance of the case and what you won on?
Was whistleblower. And whether you're working at a water treatment plant or in an environmental area, the basis of whistleblower is retaliation by your boss against you for A, either refusing to participate in, or B, and or B, taking the illegal activity to the proper authorities. And in this case, the jurors found that I was retaliated against, fired, for threatening to go to the FCC with a slanted and biased story. And there was enough evidence there that they after a five-week trial, came to that conclusion.
Mm-hmm. Now, right now, we have been covering what happened in Davos with the protests against the World Economic Forum, and on Friday covered the alternative forum that's taking place in Brazil. And on Thursday night, 1,200 people raided a Monsanto plant outside Porto Alegre in Brazil, where the alternative summit was being held, basically protesting biotechnology. Do you see links with the kind of work you tried to do and the kind of information you tried to get out?
Monsanto is almost universally hated. We have heard this very story coming out of India, where peasants who didn't want genetically engineered seed shoved down their throats went and destroyed a Monsanto plant as well. And why is there so much anger and hostility at Monsanto? Well, the president of the company, the new president of Monsanto, perhaps admitted that just in December when he said, yes, we have been arrogant, we've been aggressive, we've used bullying tactics to go after things and get them our way around the world. And he promised that they were going to change their tactics. Well, I don't know that you can put new stripes on that one, but they know they've done that. They have been arrogant and they've operated in secrecy, and that's exactly what they did with this story. They just tried to get it quashed. They figured, here, we're a couple of hayseed reporters from Tampa, Florida, and this story doesn't need to come out. It certainly is going to hurt our product, so we'll just get it killed. And unfortunately for them, it blew up in their face, and the story that would have been seen on the 6 o'clock news in Tampa, Florida, has now been heard, thanks to the Internet, around the world.
We're talking to Jane Akers, who, with Steve Wilson, attempted to put out a report, an investigative report on Monsanto and the controversial milk hormone, bovine growth hormone, RBGH, but ultimately had it pulled. And of course, you needed Fox's complicity with Monsanto to have it pulled, and you did sue Fox.
Well, we should also say that the censorship and the pressure, the editorial pressure, extended beyond just watering down the story. We were actually directed to lie, to report information that we knew to be false and misleading, and that's where we drew the line. I mean, watering down a story, I suppose that happens from time to time, and that's an editorial dispute. But when a reporter is actually asked to lie, I think they've got to draw the line, and that's what we faced.
Do you feel that more information has gotten out of Monsanto in the last 3 years from other reporters, even though your report ultimately didn't get out on television, though it did get out on the Internet?
I think that the, this bovine growth hormone is a genetically engineered drug that's injected into cows every 2 weeks so that they will give more milk. And I think the reporting of genetically engineered foods and such that we're all consuming now has been so overlooked by the American media. I mean, it just, whenever you see a story, it's, gee, we should be buying more biotech stocks because, hey, they might make us rich. And the network reporters are basically cheerleaders. They're on the bandwagon. To me, this is an incredibly important and significant story that may alter us. It may alter our environment permanently. And there's no taking it back once it's out there. Have reporters picked up on this story and run with it? No. And I listened to Jen Malochik about standing up for freedoms in other countries at your own personal risk, and I just don't see that happening in this country. I see American reporters, and I'm talking primarily broadcast because that's what I'm familiar with, as being cowardly, as worrying more about their 401ks, their lattes, and their granite countertops than standing up for anything. If it's unpopular, if it's going to hurt them politically, if it's going to get them to lose their job, They don't do it. And self-censorship is the most dangerous form of censorship. And I think it's alive and well in this country.
We're also joined on the phone by Gustavo Guriti, who won the Committee to Protect Journalists International Press Freedom Award in 1998. He was arrested in Peru. He ultimately ended up going to Panama to protect his and his family's life. And he was the first in Peru to expose Vladimiro Montesinos, Fujimori's right-hand man and head of intelligence, who ultimately has fled the country, has fled Peru, apparently still in hiding. But it was Gustavo Guriti who first took him on. Gustavo Guriti, could you explain what it was like in Peru under Fujimori? We have to say very much supported Fujimori and Montesinos by the United States for years to try to expose this shady character, Vladimiro Montesinos, as a journalist.
Well, to say that it was very hard is to obviously do it through a euphemism. The thing was that you had to contend with many things at once. First, when Fujimori was in power, for all practical purposes, they had control of most of the major media. Not that they confiscated the property, just they had the owners of the TV stations and the most important radio stations and some of the papers just to the line and cooperate very closely. Some of the videos recently been exposed that Montesinos took of almost every interview he had show several executive editors, some publishers, and some owners taking money directly from Montesinos. So for all practical purposes, these people became and had their outlets become propaganda outlets for the Fujimori regime. They silenced you completely at first. You only had recourse to use some of the magazines, some of the independent magazines. In the end, just one remained, and they had, of course, to be extremely cautious too, because they had to confront the tax police and almost a total blockade of advertising. Then one or two newspapers that had to earn the revenues just by selling at the street price, so that they were actually very costly, they were the only ones that withstood the pressure. These papers, in turn, were hounded, harassed. The intelligence service founded some tabloids whose only purpose was to attack these newspapers and especially to conduct smear campaigns on their owners and the journalists that work for them. So in other cases, there were threats. I would say that in almost all cases were threats of physical attacks, in some cases physical attacks too, and constant surveillance. You had to assume that you didn't have a private life at all. Despite all these circumstances, however, there were a number of determined investigative journalists and another just very good journalist that still continued to conduct and carry out investigations, which in the end exposed the regime. I have characterized the Fujimori dictatorship as one in which, as a war between investigative journalists and spies, having information as the battleground. In the end, of course, journalists won.
What was it like to watch the fall of Fujimori, the fleeing of Montesinos, the man that you focused on and targeted you, to where you are, where you ended up having to flee to, Panama?
Well, I didn't actually fly to Panama. I left on my own terms, Peru to the United States. I was in the United States for a relatively long time, and then I took the job I currently have in Panama. When Montesinos came here to Panama, I sort of obviously was amused at some of the ironies of destiny and made sure that he would have a very interesting stay in Panama. I, of course, had by then the advantage of knowing very well the ground, knowing all the players. So despite the fact that he was an extremely well-trained
a spy, even in terms of his own safety and secret and all that. I knew most of the time of his doings and undoings. And when he pretended to fly back secretly to Peru and perhaps to stage a coup against his former partner, Fujimori, I was able, just when his plane was taking off one of the smaller airports, to call a Peruvian TV station and tell exactly to the public who was going down there and probably what was going to happen. And that was the end of the beginning for Montesinos.
Jan Malacek, as we wrap up this discussion, how important is it to have free press?
Well, obviously, it's one of the very basic building stones for any democracy. And as you know, the democracy in the Czech Republic is only some 11 years old. It's not as firm as in the Western world. We are trying to make sure that the publicly owned television will stay free from all political influence, and I'm very happy that the people in this country and also abroad, because we also got the very strong support from international institutions and journalists, that the people actually understood how important this issue was, and they supported us in such a big degree.
And finally, Jane Akers and Steve Wilson here in the United States. Again, in the United States, people don't expect to hear discussions of censored press, etc. But your thoughts as you listen to Gustavo Guriti in Panama, who had had to leave Peru, and Jan Malacek speaking to us from Prague, Czechoslovakia, where reporters have taken over their state-owned Czech TV station.
Well, I think we're almost embarrassed to be in their company. You know, they have done so much more for freedom of the press in their respective countries than we did here. All we did was try to stand up for an honest story and sort of get bulldozed by a corporate press in the meantime. People around the world think so much of a free press that, as we've heard, they're willing to put their lives at risk, and some of them give their lives for that. And in America, these freedoms anymore are taken so much for granted. I just can't imagine a similar story. Jane talked earlier about how she believes, and I tend to agree that this is a time for American journalists to keep their heads down and not even to stand up for a story anymore. And what these people have done is just incredible. I'm embarrassed to be in the same company. They've done so much more than we have, and it just shows how important freedom of the press is.
And Amy, corporate censorship is really no different from government censorship. The end result is the same. Stories don't get out. Democracy is hurt.
They kill you in the courts.
I want to thank you all very much for being with us. Again, that was Steve Wilson and Jane Akers, who attempted to put out investigative reports on Monsanto for their Fox TV station in Tampa, Florida. Ultimately, the stories were pulled, and they had to sue their own news organization. Gustavo Guriti, speaking to us from Panama, he took on the Fujimori Vladimir Montesinos nexus in Peru, and Jan Malacek, speaking to us from the state-owned Czech TV station in Prague, Czech Republic. You're listening to Pacific Radio's Democracy Now! Back in a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The death toll from Friday's earthquake in India is at tens of thousands and mounting. It's too early to determine the extent that corruption, substandard housing, and lack of official planning played in increasing the death toll. But in the quake that hit El Salvador 2 weeks ago, the role of the government and international financial institutions in exacerbating the disaster has become clear. Daniel Faber and Jacob Goldstein have written, "Thousands of those who died were not killed by an act of God. They were killed by acts of humankind." They go on to say, "A long history of development built on economic inequalities and disregard for local ecosystems has created a landscape on the brink of disaster." The writers were referring to Hurricane Mitch, which ravaged Central America in 1998, but the same dynamic was at play during the recent earthquake that devastated El Salvador and parts of Guatemala. From the Florida Keys to the floodplains of Bangladesh, from the coast of Venezuela to the mountainside developments in Central America, intense construction in known risk areas, sometimes coupled with heavy deforestation, make disaster inevitable. We're going to go right now to Ricardo Navarro, who's director of Center for Appropriate Technology and chair of Friends of the Earth International in San Salvador. Also, Daniel Faber is with us, a professor at Northeastern University and former research director for the Environmental Project on Central America, author of the award-winning book Environment Under Fire. Ricardo Navarro, let's start with you on the earthquake that recently struck your country, El Salvador. Can you describe what's happened there?
Yeah, you see, an earthquake has two levels. On one hand is the power of the natural phenomenon, but on the other hand is the vulnerability of the region. And this part is our problem. We have said for the last 8 years, hundreds of times, and I have hundreds of press articles here, we told the government, do not allow constructions in Cordillera El Bálsamo, among other things. We told the government that many, many times. We went to the Legislative Assembly, and the right-wing politicians opposed our petition to declare that area as a zone of ecological protection, as a forest area. We went to the Supreme Court. They did not agree with us. We went to the General Attorney's Office. They said no. We went to the central government, Ministry of the Environment. They said no. Now we have the problem. More than 300 houses were buried in Santa Tecla, in a place called Las Colinas. In some of the streets that are now covered by a landslide of 5 meters high, in those streets we were marching. And we were telling the people, we are scared that the mountain is going to collapse. You should not allow constructions in that area. Now this is the result. That is why we accuse our central government, the Legislative Assembly, the Supreme Court, the General Attorney's Office, and the construction industry, we accuse them of sharing the responsibility of the tragedy that is affecting the people in El Salvador.
Who was killed? How many people were killed?
Well, according to government figures, it's about 700. But the problem is that there are a lot of people that were walking, you know, in the middle of a street. There was a landslide. They are killed, and nobody knows about them. For example, here, my vice chair of CESTA, the day I was looking in Santa Tecla, we found half of his body, the lower half. We could identify because of some papers. Yesterday, we found the other half, the upper part, and the upper part was properly buried, you know, with all Christian rituals and things like that. The lower part was not, because the government put it in a common grave, you know, because of all the dangers, they said. But yesterday, we paid a little bribe to the guys that were digging, and they said, okay, take the corpse quick, because otherwise, you know, it's going to be difficult. So we managed to give him a Christian burial yesterday. And this thing, I mean, many, many, many cases like this. I have seen people trying to figure out whether a given corpse belonged to her mother, because the face was totally destroyed, but maybe the color of the clothes, trying to remember if that dress belonged to her mother, these kind of things. So it's really very bad. But as I said, we hold the government responsible for this because we told them hundreds of times. And I have here in my office a lot of paper, newspaper clippings that show. And if you go now to the place, they will tell you. The government should have heard the ecologists when they were saying that.
What about, Ricardo Navarro, the role of corruption in the whole scandal around development?
Oh, certainly. This is why the government the government of El Salvador did never accept our petition to have that cordillera, El Bálsamo, as a ecological area. It's not because they are idiots. I mean, some of them are idiots, but I don't think that's the main point. Is they know very well that the danger is there, but construction industry makes a lot of money, and they bribe politicians. You know, here, for example, just across of my, in the back of my office, there is a stone quarry, you know, where they extract stone. We told the government, that thing is going to collapse. Well, the day of the earthquake, I saw when a little bit of the mountain collapsed. That little bit was enough to kill three people. And we told the general attorney's office, I said 3 months ago, the general attorney is responsible if something is going to happen, if something happens, because he stopped the investigation. And he stopped it because he is a friend of the guy who owns the stone quarry. You know, now there are three people. I have asked the general attorney, what about these three people killed? And they don't answer anything.
We're talking to Ricardo Navarro in El Salvador, director of the Center for Appropriate Technology and Friends of the Earth International. He's chair of that organization. Daniel Faber joins us from Massachusetts Northeastern University. What about the role, Daniel Faber, of the World Bank and the IMF?
Well, I think the World Bank and IMF, as well as U.S. government, has played a profound role in creating the structural conditions for the disasters which we have seen plague Central America over the last three decades, the latest, of course, being Hurricane Mitch in 1998, which did kill over 11,000 people, rendered millions of people homeless, and essentially devastated the economies of Honduras and Nicaragua. And I think U.S. policy and the role of the World Bank and IMF have been instrumental in the sense that they promoted a development model which has served a narrow interest of the wealthy in countries such as El Salvador to the detriment of the majority of the population. In particular, they promoted a model of economic development which has resulted in the monopolization of the best lands and best natural resources in the hands of a small class of wealthy landowners. As a result, millions of people have been displaced onto ecologically fragile hillsides that are unsuitable for agriculture, where they clear the trees, and that sets the conditions for which landslides can occur, or they reside in other zones which are considered dangerous, such as floodplains, and because they lack the types of resources they need, the housing that they have is often inadequate. So what you have, if you look at the history of Central America, you find that these long lines of natural disasters are really, in a large degree, preventable. They're socially produced disasters, and they're grounded in these policies which have promoted environmental destruction, poverty, and economic inequality. And you find that this is rather a typical event. In El Salvador, for example, in the early 1980s, around 1982, Montebello, peasants that had been displaced by the confiscation of agricultural lands by the oligarchy, these large landed elites, moved to this mountain outside San Salvador, cleared the mountain of its trees in order to plant food to feed themselves and their families. The rains come, causes a massive avalanche that wipes out the community below the mountain, kills about 1,000 people. So to a large degree, these disasters are preventable. You can't prevent natural phenomena from occurring, such as hurricanes and earthquakes, but the death and destruction that they reap can be prevented, and that this has been a major function of the IMF and the World Bank and the U.S. government in creating these conditions, which lead to disaster.
Ricardo Navarro, in El Salvador, can you see specifically now with the earthquake that took place, the connection of the IMF and the World Bank?
Oh, certainly, certainly. You see, the problem here, more than the earthquake, is poverty. You know, why the houses collapsed? Because houses were very weak. Why? Because the World Bank and the IMF, they order the government of El Salvador to follow some of these globalization, you know, rules and kind of things. And what does that mean in practice in El Salvador? That all the production apparatus is geared towards providing more benefits to the rich people, to the rich corporations. And the poor guys, it doesn't matter. The environment doesn't matter. So I certainly do believe that the World Bank, the IMF, Inter-American Development Bank, and all these guys, they are also responsible because they have generated the conditions for the earthquake to be much worse. You know, because I am sure an earthquake in a country that is, you know, like Germany, let's say, or the United States maybe, it certainly doesn't have the toll that it has in a country like El Salvador because of poverty. So they are also to be blamed for that.
Yeah, if I could add to what Ricardo is saying here, one of the major impacts of the IMF and World Bank has been policies of structural adjustment. And particularly following Mitch, one of the essence of structural adjustment is that Central America is to pay off its debt to the World Bank and the international lending community through increasing its exports. So what you get as a result of that is increased pressure on natural resources within the country, increased pressure to reduce wages. At the same time, there's increased pressure placed upon the Salvador government and the people to reduce public expenditures. And that includes spending for health services, for emergency relief services, for environmental protection, and so forth. So you get increased resource exploitation on one hand and less types of services that could mitigate the impact of a disaster on the other. And so if you look at El Salvador now, it's one of the most ecologically devastated countries in the hemisphere. More than 95% of the country is deforested. 77% of the country is severely eroded. 40% of all the land that was deemed by the U.S. government to be unsuitable for development has been developed. So when you have a hurricane or when you have an earthquake, it's no accident that you have these disasters on these types of lands that have become so degraded, and that's a function of World Bank and IMF policy.
This recent earthquake, how many people is it estimated died, Ricardo Navarro?
Well, the government has said now, last night they said it's close to 700, and that means the corpses they have found, I would assume it's probably twice as much at least, because, you see, a lot of people, it's even probable that they didn't have any IDs, you know, and I am sure the government is going to put the figure lower, because they are doing the counting, you know, they're going to put the figure lower to reduce the image, the bad image of this. As a matter of fact, when we had the earthquake, they started saying that it was 5.2. I mean, we have experience with earthquakes, with tremors, and you know, 5.2 doesn't make that you know, big impact. And I felt that extremely big impact. I said that when people asked me what was the magnitude, I said between 7 and 8. And the United States, I don't know exactly from where, but a geological office in the United States, they said 7.6. And now people say, people accept it was 7.6, maybe 7.7, that, you know, or 7.8 even, some people are arguing. But the government tried to put the number down. I mean, this is, I believe, is going to happen also with counting the people dead and counting the damage. They're going to put the number down, not to be held responsible.
And of the people who died, of the about 1,000 people who died, in terms of their economic status, were they mainly poor?
Mostly people in rural areas. For example, we have in Tecoluca, that's a community where CESTA works environmentally, there are about 1,300 houses. All of them were destroyed. So that specific case is similar to very many in El Salvador.
Well, we have to wrap up right now. That was Daniel Faber, professor of Northeastern University, former research director for the Environmental Project on Central America, and Ricardo Navarro, director of the Center for Appropriate. appropriate technology and chair of Friends of the Earth International in San Salvador, El Salvador. That does it for the show. Democracy Now! Is produced by Terry Allen and Chris Abrams. Anthony Sloan is our engineer. From the embattled studios of WBAI, from the studios of The Band and the Fired, from the studios of our listeners, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!